seems like a great place here. My first time at the Fremburn Institute. So today I'm going to tell, I kind of have two talks in one. The main subject of the talk is what I've written here, an effort we're doing here in the US called NanoGrav that I'll tell you a lot about, which aims to use radio observations of millisecond pulsars as a gravitational wave detector. So I'll talk in a bunch of detail about that. The second thing I'm going to talk about, if I don't go horribly over time, is some recent work I've been doing, which is related, but focusing on kind of new data analysis methods aimed at figuring out how we can best use the information contained in the radio pulsar signals that gets imprinted on it by its propagation through the ionized interstellar medium. So from the gravitational wave detection aspect or viewpoint, this is sort of a nuisance because it's noise, but it also lets us study the properties of the ISM in some interesting ways. And I'm going to force you guys to sit through a few slides of what are pulsars, what are gravitational waves at the beginning, just in case everyone's not quite up to speed on that. Right, so I'm sure this is old news to many of you, but the objects we're talking about that we observe in this experiment as radio pulsars are neutron stars. So these are stellar remnants that exist in our galaxy. These are compact remnants of a massive star that underwent a supernova explosion and ended its life that way. If the star was too massive, it would have left behind a black hole. If it was less massive, it would have left behind a white dwarf. In this case, what we have left behind is a neutron star. So this is basically a little ball of neutrons here that's supported by the neutron degeneracy pressure. That's why it didn't just collapse completely down into a black hole. But aside from black hole, this is the densest form of matter that we know of existing anywhere in the universe. They typically have around 1.4, 1.5 solar masses, so 1.4 times the mass of the sun squeezed into a sphere that's about 10 kilometers in radius. So this is a pretty extreme object. It's kind of neat to study because it's despite being an astronomical object, this size scale is very human. You know, it's the size of a city, so that's a kind of cool feature of this. Some more extreme properties of neutron stars, they have a wide range of magnetic fields, all of which are very strong, at least compared to things like terrestrial magnetic fields. The surface magnetic field on a neutron star is anywhere from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 12 Gauss. And on top of that, they're spinning in some cases quite rapidly, so just due to the conservation of angular momentum and some other processes, which I'll talk about on the next slide. Neutron stars that we observe are typically spinning with spin periods of a few seconds down to 1.5 milliseconds. And the reason we're able to do any of this and learn about these objects is because on top of this, they're emitting a broadband radio beam from the plasma that exists in the magnetosphere of the object here. So in the typical pulsar picture that I grabbed off the internet, you have the neutron star here at the middle. The rotation axis is vertical. That's the green line there. The magnetic field is roughly dipole in shape, is inclined with respect to the rotation axis. So you have this beam that comes out, thought to be pretty much aligned along the magnetic field axis, a beam of radio emission. And due to just the kind of natural lighthouse style effect of this beamed radiation and the spinning, we see these pulses of radio waves. If the beam happens to sweep by the Earth, we see a pulse once per rotation. The beamed radio emission, which is our excellent tool for investigating these objects, it's generated by plasma interactions in the star's magnetosphere. And understanding exactly why these things emit radio waves is still an active research topic, which is kind of a polite way of saying we don't really know what's going on. But a large chunk of pulsar physics, including most of the stuff I do, takes the viewpoint that we're going to take advantage. We don't really care too much why exactly the radio waves are being emitted. We can still study the properties of the radiation from an experimental viewpoint. And we can take advantage of this as kind of a naturally occurring pulsed signal source. It's a thing sitting out there in our galaxy. It's sending these blips of radio waves. They propagate through stuff, possibly through gravitational waves, through the space-time metric, definitely through the interstellar medium. We're going to take advantage of this as sort of a nice natural signal generator to make some very precise astrophysical measurements. So the objects that are most interesting to do this kind of study with are the millisecond pulsars. So this is about 10% of the known, the visible radio population, visible radio pulsar population in our galaxy. These are also called recycled pulsars. The reason why is that they've gone through a particular evolutionary process here, shown in this cartoon. So for these objects, they're binary stars. They start off their life with a companion object. So you have a massive star in a binary orbit with a less massive star. The more massive and hotter star burns up first, ends its life, becomes a neutron star. If the companion survives this supernova process, eventually it starts ending its life. It puffs up into a red giant and starts contributing matter through the Roche-Loeb overflow here onto the neutron star. So this spins up the neutron star, converting it from probably an object spinning at a few seconds over here into something that's spinning up to several hundred times per second, so a millisecond pulsar. The final endpoint in most cases of this process is you're left here with a white dwarf now. This is the remnant of the less massive companion star. So you have a white dwarf, which this picture is not really to scale, but this is a very compact object also. This star is supported by electron degeneracy pressure. It's less massive than a neutron star, but still very compact. White dwarf in orbit with a now millisecond pulsar. And one of the nice things about this is that this is a very clean system. I mean, this is essentially two-point masses in a very compact orbit. So it gives you a nice system to do some very interesting physics with. And in some cases, actually, you can end up with a neutron star binary if this companion was a bit more massive. But most of the ones I'm talking about today are these neutron star white dwarf binaries. So the reason why we're able to do all the cool physics that we're going to do with these things is because we're able to track these radio pulses over very long times, over decades, and essentially use these objects as very precise astronomical clocks. So we see something like this. This is the pulse train coming from this one millisecond pulsar, 1937 plus 21. This one has a spin period of 1.5 milliseconds. It has emission here. It has what we call an interpulse halfway through its spin period. So we track the phase of this pulse train over decades. And that gives us precision to say things like the average spin period of this pulsar over the last, say, 10 or 20 years was 1.557 da-da-da-da with 15 significant digits on it. So this very high precision stable clock embedded in a kind of extreme orbit becomes a really nice laboratory for exploring physics. And this has been used to do a lot of things, most of which I'm not going to be talking about today, but just want to mention for context here. These systems are very nice laboratories for testing gravity, theories of gravity and general relativity, testing whether or not general relativity is the correct description of gravity in this regime. Because of their extreme density, the most, as I said already, the most dense form of matter that we know to exist, if you can explore, if you can measure bulk properties of the neutron star itself, for example, its mass and its radius, this lets you say some very interesting stuff about nuclear physics and what happens when you squeeze matter to these extreme densities. So this is a very, very interesting topic that's not in this talk, but I'd be happy to talk with anyone about afterwards. And then the thing that I'm going to spend most of my time on is basically just using this high precision clock as sort of a test source in a gravitational wave detection experiment. So to go into a little bit more detail about how we do this, as I said, we track the rotation of the star over many decades. We develop what we call a phase-connected timing model. So this is a model that predicts the apparent phase, spin phase of the star over decades based on physical parameters such as its intrinsic spin rate, its spin down rate, which is determined by its magnetic field, the astrometry. We need to know exactly where it is on the sky. So we can subtract out the Doppler shifts due to the Earth's motion, and then the properties of its binary orbit. And so when we do this, just here's an example here of some pulsar data from one object we're observing as part of our gravitational wave detection experiment. You see sort of these are what we call pulse timing residuals. So it's basically the phase shift data minus model after fitting for all this stuff. Converted into time units, and you can see these have a scatter of less than a microsecond over about 10 years. So that fractional accuracy is basically where you get the kind of part in 10 to the 15 precision that I mentioned on the other slide. Yeah, I'll talk about this a lot at the end of the talk. This is due to the interstellar medium, basically either magnifying or demagnifying the strength of the radio signal. But I have a bunch of examples of this later on in the talk. Just a brief slide about some of the, don't worry about the equations, but a brief slide about some of the stuff we can measure from binary orbits. If you can measure a bunch of the standard orbital parameters, such as the binary period and such. On top of that, you can measure, for very compact objects, these relativistic parameters, such as the precession of the orbit, the change in time of, over the orbital period. And the only free parameters in here when you, when you assume general relativity are the two masses of the object. So if you can measure these observationally, once you have two of them, you can determine the masses. Once you have three or more of these relativistic orbital effects measured, then you can do the kinds of analyses that let you constrain whether or not general relativity is actually a correct description of gravity, so testing the consistency of general relativity. So these are some of the things that go into these timing models. A typical timing model has anywhere between 10 and 20 parameters, depending on how many of these you need to include for a certain orbit.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Is there an intuitive understanding for range and shape? Does that relate to the pulse profiles? Or is there some intuitive way of understanding how that relates? Or is it just the name that was given to these particular
quantities? Yeah, the range and shape. I feel like these probably came from radar somehow, these terms. Basically, physically, let's see which one is which here. Physically, range is the amplitude. So these two parameters describe the Shapiro delay signal, which is a delay of the a relativistic delay of the radio pulse as it travels by the companion star, right? And the range is just the overall amplitude of the effect, which is proportional to the mass of the companion star. More massive companion causes more delay. And the shape is how sharply peaked it is, which physically just depends on the inclination of the orbit. So a very edge-on orbit gives you a very sharply peaked Shapiro delay, whereas a more face-on orbit gives you a much more like sinusoidal-looking thing as a function of orbital phase.
So is the range the amplitude of
the residuals? The range, it's not the there's some weirdness about the fit affecting things. It's the amplitude of the pre-timing model fit Shapiro delay signal. So depending on what other stuff you're fitting out of it, it's not always exactly the amplitude of the residuals. But yeah, to order of magnitude, sure, right? Yeah. So the main type of pulsar experiment that I'm going to talk about today has to do with gravitational waves, which again, this is probably pretty remedial for most of you guys in this room. But as you know, I'm sure you all know, gravitational waves are these freely propagating space-time ripples, basically wave solutions of Einstein's equation, predicted obviously by general relativity. Generated by moving mass in most configurations. So in an astrophysical context, we're almost always talking about binaries here. Of course, gravity is very weak, and a direct detection of gravitational waves has not yet been made. And so the kind of two high-level reasons for why we think this project is interesting is first that we just want to confirm that gravitational waves exist as we think they should. And second, what a lot of people would probably consider more interesting is that this provides sort of a new window onto the universe. So to date, almost all of our information about astronomy comes from electromagnetic observations, you know, radio to gamma ray and everything in between. Gravitational waves are a whole other spectrum of information that will be available to us when we can start detecting them. So gravitational waves, like electromagnetic waves, come in two polarizations. These are called the plus and cross polarizations based on sort of what they do to an initially stationary circle of test particles here as a gravitational wave propagates through the board. So these are quadrupolar waves. So these two polarization modes are rotated 45 degrees with respect to each other rather than 90 degrees. And the strength of a gravitational wave is quantified by a dimensionless quantity we call strain, which is just the little perturbation on the GR metric tensor. We, by convention, always give it the letter H. And basically, this is a fractional change in length. So sort of delta radius over radius of this circle here. And typical values of the metric strain that we expect to see here on Earth coming from astronomical sources is tiny. So anywhere between, say, 10 to the minus 20 to up to 10 to the minus 15, depending on exactly what frequency and source you're talking about and such. So these are highly exaggerated for display purposes, obviously. There have been a lot of gravitational wave detection experiments over time, but all modern experiments, the ones that are ongoing right now that expect to have a chance of actually detecting something, work on basically the same physical principle. They use light as a probe of the gravitational field. So for example, in a laser interferometer, if you imagine that kind of, you know, the little pulsating circle on top of this, if a gravitational wave is coming out of the board, it's going to change the length of this interferometer arm with respect to this one. And so you'll see that modulation show up in your interference pattern down here at the detector. So in this case, the strain sensitivity that you get with your instrument, H, is approximately delta L over L. So the length of your interferometer arms And this is how precisely you can measure a change in distance. And as one example of this, I know some of you at least are familiar with this, this is an experiment called LIGO that is aiming to do exactly this. And so that the kind of L shape you see here are the two arms of the laser interferometer. But so despite a lot of effort, so far no one has directly detected gravitational waves. It's sort of a nice connection back to the pulsars that so far the only experimental evidence in favor of gravitational waves comes from pulsar timing. So this is getting back to this concept of timing the relativistic binary double neutron star systems. And there's a very famous experiment done by Hulse and Taylor over several decades, again here, where they timed this double neutron star system called 1913 plus 16 and measured the change in its orbit, so the change in the orientation of the orbit and binary period over time. This orbital change exactly matches the expected energy loss to gravitational waves that's predicted by general relativity. So this is a really classic experiment in GR, and won these guys the Nobel Prize back in the 90s for this. And this has since been repeated by a couple other on a couple different binary systems as well. So what we're aiming to do now is not detect gravitational waves that are being emitted by neutron star binary systems, but just to use these systems as precise clocks to detect any gravitational waves that might be passing through our galaxy. So this is kind of a galactic scale gravitational wave detector. And it turns out that this experiment is sensitive to very low frequency gravitational waves, typically on the order of nanohertz. The way this works is really the same as the laser experiments. You have light, in this case radio pulses emitted from the pulsar. They travel through the wiggly space-time metric to Earth. As they're going, this metric perturbation is effectively changing the length, the path length between the pulsar and Earth. And so the pulses experience a time delay relative to what they would have, what their travel time would have been in flat space. That's basically the integral of the metric perturbation along the line of sight, times some unit vectors pointing in the right direction. And so the key thing about this for us is that this overall delta t, this time shift of the pulse, is time variable. If this is a wave, this is oscillating at the wave period. And because this is a variable path length difference, it's going to show up with that same frequency in our timing residuals, and we can potentially detect it. So this, as I said already, this is exactly the same principle as the laser experiments. But of course, there's some differences in the details here. In the case of the laser experiments, we had H is approximately delta L over L, so the key parameter of your experiment is the arm length of your interferometer. In our case, pulsars are thousands of light years away, and we don't have thousands of years of data. So in our case, the same parameter, the analogous parameter is the total time we've been observing, so it's our observational time span rather than the interferometer arm length. So the strain amplitudes we're talking about are delta T over T. Delta T is the timing precision, and big T is our observational time span so far. So this basically sets the frequency scale we're talking about also. And compared to the laser interferometers, we're working in a very short wavelength limit. So we're looking for gravitational waves with a period comparable to our observation duration. But there are many, many of these wavelengths between here and the pulsar, thousands of them. The other thing that's kind of unique to the pulsar timing experiments is because the pulsar parameters, like its spin and spin down rate and such, are not known a priori. So we have to figure this out from the same data that we're trying to detect gravitational waves in. And so that gives us this characteristic shape in sensitivity versus frequency. We're fitting for these pulsar parameters, such as the period and the spin down rate, cause a loss of sensitivity on the low frequency end. And a few of these other things, like fitting for position on the sky and parallax, cause notches at 1 year and half a year period here. I think I meant to put this slide first, but a neat feature of all this is that, while of course everyone wants to be the first to detect gravitational waves, all these different experiments are actually very complementary. So this plot is the kind of overall gravitational wave spectrum, so log frequency here showing 14 orders of magnitude and log strain amplitude here. And you can see pulsar timing arrays down here on the nanohertz end of things, and LIGO is up here in the kilohertz end of things. So just as you have, radio waves up to gamma rays and the electromagnetic spectrum, you have exactly analogous situation here in the gravitational wave spectrum. And so we expect to see different types of astrophysical sources in each of these different frequency ranges. And for pulsar timing arrays, if you can look at the kind of expected source amplitude, which are the colored regions here, we're talking about typical strain amplitudes in the ballpark of, say, 10 to the minus 15-ish strains. That means when you convert that to a delta T, you know, if we observe for a couple of years, that means we need timing precision on the orders of tens of nanoseconds. So that's somewhat challenging experimentally. Another kind of unique feature of the pulsar experiments is how are we actually going to prove that some weird wiggle we see in the timing residuals is a gravitational wave? And the key thing to note here, which is what makes it a pulsar timing array, is that we're observing a bunch of pulsars. And a gravitational wave passing through our galaxy is going to actually induce correlated timing perturbations among this set of pulsars. So this is really why we can do it. If we were just looking at a single pulsar and we saw something weird, you know, that might be interesting, but I don't think it would be very convincing to anyone that that's not just some weird irregularity that that pulsar in particular is doing, some irregularity in its spin down rate or whatever. And so depending on the type of gravitational wave signal you're looking for, this correlation takes different forms. And the classic one is this thing called the Hellings and Downs curve, which was proposed by these guys in the early 80s, that says for an isotropic gravitational wave background, you expect to see this correlation between the timing of pairs of pulsars that's only a function of the angular separation of the pairs. So pulsars that are close in the sky have highly correlated timing residuals, becomes anti-correlated near 90 degrees, and then comes back up again near 180 degrees. And the basic shape of this just comes from the kind of quadrupolar gravitational wave formula. Yeah?
What are the, you probably had it on the previous slide, I just didn't see it fast enough, but what are the sources that give rise to gravitational waves with wavelength of order the size of the galaxy or the size of the distance?
So yeah, I probably skipped over that a bit quick. We're actually not looking, the wavelength here is not actually the scale of the galaxy. The wavelength is a light year, whereas the pulsar is 1,000 light years away. And roughly, the type of signal that gives you a gravitational wave with a wavelength of a light year is a binary that has a period of order years, right? So we're talking about supermassive black hole binaries. Actually, I probably have this on it. Here we go. I have this on my next slide. We're talking about supermassive black hole binaries, and the point in which their life that we see them is when they're orbiting with periods of years. And they're in our band. As they evolve, the orbits get faster, and they move out of our band and up into the LISA band, if LISA were to exist.
So maybe this is a silly question, but mm-hmm. I imagine like this source is emitting some wave packet of gravitational waves.
The black hole binary is.
Black hole binary, yeah. Right? Because it starts at some time, and mm-hmm. it ramps up, and then it dissipates.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the point at which for us, we're viewing these sources when they're still more like a continuous wave. So it's not like a burst really, although there are some ideas for detecting bursts. It's more like a spike in frequency. So there's this continuous wave at a certain frequency that's passing through our galaxy.
So right. The mathematical assumption is that it's like a plane wave. The scale of the galaxy, the wave packet is bigger.
That's right. Well, yeah, I don't have these details in here, but there are ideas about looking for the wavefront curvature, which would be very interesting, because then that actually gets you measuring distances and stuff. But basically, yeah, for the kind of isotropic background, so this has been the classic pulsar timing race signal type, is the stochastic background, just the sum of all these binaries throughout the universe. In that case, yeah, you just treat them all as independent plane waves and add them up, and you get that characteristic correlation curve. But yeah, if there was a single massive black hole binary close enough to stick up as a spike in the spectrum, you could start looking for things like the curvature of the wavefront, measuring distance, which are pretty interesting. And then, of course, since this is kind of unexplored territory, people propose a lot of exotic stuff as well. So the massive black hole binaries are the things we expect to be there at the centers of galaxies, post-galaxy merger and such. But there are a lot of ideas about cosmic strings and maybe other stuff as well. I don't know that number off the top of my head. No.
It seems like it'd be really far away to be in the far field. You've got enormous effect.
I think you stated the other way. I think I forget the authors, but there was a few years ago there was this paper that estimated how close the source has to be to detect the curvature of the wavefront.
Sure.
And it has to be, something like two supermassive black holes closer than
So let's see. I'm going to get on to talking about our experiment here. So there's actually a bunch of people trying to do this around the world. There's three main pulsar timing experiments now. There's a group in Australia using the Parkes telescope called the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array. There's a group in Europe using several of the large radio dishes in Europe called the European Pulsar Timing Array. And the effort that I'm involved with is based here in North America. So it's mainly US and Canadian people working on this called NanoGrav, the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves. And we use the two large US radio telescopes, Arecibo and the Green Bank telescope here. And there have been some, there's an ongoing effort, which is kind of slowly ramping up over the last couple of years, for all of us to kind of pool our data and work together, called the International Pulsar Timing Array. And so that's an ongoing effort, but we are actually starting to do it now, and sharing data and doing combined analyses and stuff. So here's a picture of our collaboration NanoGrav at one of our yearly meetings at Arecibo earlier this year. At the time, so this is a smallish group, so it was on the order of 30 or 40 people, about 15 senior researchers, postdocs and grad students, and spread out over 14 institutions across the US and Canada. So it's a small group, fairly geographically distributed, but we've been getting together a couple times a year for workshops like this, and that's been very helpful. And of course, we have a webpage, so please check out nanograv.org if you want to read a little bit more about who's in this and what we're all working on. So the two telescopes we use for our experiment are Arecibo. So this is a big 300-meter radio dish that's in Puerto Rico. This is the largest single-dish telescope in the world. Actually, it's the largest telescope in the world in terms of collecting area. So the big 300-meter dish is set on the ground here. This thing can't move. And the way you point this telescope at different sources is by moving the receivers. So the receivers hang on this little platform above the telescope inside this dome. And you can rotate this thing around and move this back and forth on this arm to point at different sources. But this puts a limitation that you can only point at things that are 20 degrees off vertical, right? So you can see a limited range of the sky, and as objects pass overhead, you can only see them for at most about 2 hours at a time. The other telescope we use is the Green Bank telescope in West Virginia. This is operated by NRAO. This is a 100-meter telescope. It's the largest fully steerable telescope in the world. So in this case, this is more like your classic radio dish. You can point the whole thing anywhere on the sky, down to 5 degrees above the horizon. And so this is a smaller collecting area than Arecibo, but it's much better sky coverage allows it to see many more pulsars. And so in the end, these two telescopes contribute approximately equally to our gravitational wave sensitivity. We started doing this project in about 2005. We're currently monitoring 35 pulsars, although we started with a smaller set. We had a paper out earlier this year that I was first author on that analyzed the first 5 years of data and actually publicly released it. So you can go to my webpage and download the actual data that went into this if any of you are so interested in playing around with it. We do these observations at a couple different radio frequencies, approximately once a month. We look at each pulsar for about an hour, split the time equally between two different radio bands. So here's kind of an overview of how the data looked for this first 5 years of the project. These are these 17 different pulsars we're observing. These are the timing residuals. They're all kind of on the microsecond scale, although some are much better than others, as you can see. Some have some bigger scatter here. Some are much more clustered around zero. It basically just depends on how bright the pulsar is. Therefore, we can time it more accurately. There's this gap in the middle here where both the telescopes happen to be shut down one summer for repairs. And so here's kind of the table that describes how these timing residuals look. The key thing to take away from this is that the two best objects in our set have RMS timing residuals on the order of 40 nanoseconds. So that's pretty good. That's starting to get towards our goal, 10 nanoseconds over many years, although we would like to see this level of accuracy for more pulsars. So there's some stuff we're doing to get there that I'll get to later on in the talk. Just here's a zoom in on the timing residuals from these two best sources, 1713 and 1909. Okay, so how do we actually go about trying to measure a gravitational wave signal from this data? So the main complication that comes into all this is a thing I alluded to earlier, that you have to account for all the other stuff that you determined from the data. So account for the pulsar's binary parameters, account for its position on the sky and such, and then look for gravitational waves and whatever's left over. And the method that, and there are several approaches to this. The approach that we took in this analysis was to developed this thing called the R matrix that basically tells you how you connect your prefit data to your postfit residuals. And then you can use that to figure out what a gravitational wave of a given spectral shape will look like in terms of its covariance matrix in the postfit data, time domain covariance matrix. We play some tricks with diagonalizing this to put things in the best basis to do this analysis, and we're able to measure from a single pulsar, put limits on how strong a gravitational wave spectrum of a certain shape would be. But then what we really want to do is do this cross-correlation. So we use the single pulsar noise parameters that we determined to do this kind of optimally weighted cross-correlation, and we basically measure that correlation factor, that Helmholtz and Downs curve that I showed earlier. So for each pair of pulsars, we get a data point here. We see how much of their time and residual power is correlated between the two, and then we try to fit for a curve of the appropriate shape. So this is how the data look. The colors are just a code to indicate the points with the lowest error bars. So we have 17 pulsars in the set. The range of RMS time and residuals is over an order of magnitude, so the range of error bars in the cross correlations is a couple orders of magnitude. So most of the power to do this measurement comes from the best maybe 10 or 20 cross correlations, and then all the other ones with the huge error bars I just have grayed out and back here. We do actually use all of them in the fit, but it's only these that really determine the measurement. So this is still consistent with zero. We don't detect this correlation pattern, and we put a limit on a isotropic stochastic, I should have also put power law, spectrum gravitational wave background at this level, 7 by 10 to the minus 15, at a reference frequency of 1 year. So here's kind of how that looks. We're going back to gravitational wave frequency space. Here's the kind of approximate sensitivity versus frequency we have. And what we're basically doing is doing a measurement of the power at approximately 1/5 years. So that's that star here. And then we're interpreting it in terms of what's the biggest, what's the highest amplitude massive black hole spectrum you could have, be still consistent with the data. And there's a different number for the cosmic strings because they're expected to have a different spectral slope.
Yep. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is from the actual data.
It's not some expected thing.
It's not what?
It's not the expected. It's not a forecast.
No, not a forecast. This is real data. I got some forecasts coming up. Go ahead. Sure.
I kind of
skipped by it really quickly earlier. This is a spike at exactly 1 year period. And this comes from the fact that we have to fit out for the pulsar's position on the sky. So it basically removes all power at 1 year period. So we can't ever detect an exactly 1 year gravitational wave. Although as we get more data, the width of this narrows. So this was the kind of classic pulsar timing gravitational wave signal to isotropic stochastic background analysis. That's been published so far. And there are some in prep things looking for other types of signals. So for example, looking for continuous wave signals, this would be the spike in frequency space, I'm gonna say a spike here, from a single nearby black hole binary. So far no detections here, and this is the resulting sensitivity versus frequency for this type of analysis. And then I was talking a bit about this at lunch, there's recently been kind of an increase in interest in looking for these things called gravitational wave bursts with memory, which I don't really understand the physics behind the source or between the generation of gravitational wave signal quite so well. But the idea is that due to the nonlinearity of gravity, following an actual merger event, so supermassive black holes eventually merge together into a single black hole after they've radiated away all their orbital energy to gravitational waves, the idea is that there's a permanent step in the metric at the point where the two black holes actually coalesce. And this would actually show up in pulsar timing residuals, and it would look like, basically, it would look like what we call a glitch, which is a sudden change in the pulsar spin period. So in terms of residuals, you would see flat, 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 and then when the burst goes by, a sudden change in period causes a ramp upwards. So this is kind of interesting, because I think this is something that's not easily detectable by the interferometer experiments, so this is kind of a unique thing we might be able to do with pulsar timing arrays. Oh, I should point out this was real data, but I added a huge signal into it, so this is not an actual detection of anything. And similar to how there's the correlation versus angular separation for the stochastic background, the kind of key thing here that identifies this as a gravitational wave as opposed to an actual pulsar glitch is that you would see basically what looks like a glitch at the same time in all the pulsars you're observing. So that's pretty hard to generate any other way. Okay, so now on to the forecast section. The simplest way for things to get better is to just wait. In some sense, time is on our side for these experiments because our observational frequency, gravitational wave frequency, is set by our observation duration. If we take more data, continue to increase the observational time span, we push to lower and lower gravitational wave frequencies where the sources are expected to be stronger. So these various classes of sources all tend to have these red spectra where there's more gravitational wave power at lower frequencies. So just collecting more data lets us observe those lower frequencies and gives us a better chance of detecting things. So that's one thing that's always ongoing.
That's great.
Yeah, sure.
About two slides ago. So
yeah.
The claim is that before and after you see the gravitational wave burst, there's a change in the
apparent
asymptotic frequency.
A change in the apparent pulsar spin frequency, yeah.
But
it's like
frequency, the residual.
Well, we observe residuals, yeah. So a step in frequency is a ramp in residuals.
Before and after the gravitational wave frequency, if there's a burst of gravitational waves that goes by, I guess before and after, don't you just see the pulsar frequency as the actual pulsar frequency, sort of unmodified?
Yeah, this is getting into.
I think it causes a step in the a zero offset overall of the arrival.
Yeah,
well, the
memory of the gravity.
Hmm?
It's the memory, I think, that's going to be that effect, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's that funny step.
But the redshift, so the local redshift is the square root of that tree. So
oh, you mean it's like, oh, yes, sir. It's like another, in another coordinate, it's like saying pulsar has a residual velocity.
Yeah, that's right. But what we're measuring is the integral of that, right? So that's why it's a ramp, not a step. Right, so we have a bunch of other stuff going on also that we think is going to improve the measurement. So I've mentioned a few of these efforts already, but there's a number of different data analysis techniques that people are working on and trying out. A key thing that's been going on over the last couple of years is the discovery of a lot of new millisecond pulsars. These have been added to our experiment. And we've also, in the last couple of years, had a major upgrade in the instrumentation we use at the telescope. So this is the digital instrumentation that processes the radio signal that we measure from the disk, measure coming off the telescope. So the new digital backends can process about an order of magnitude more radio bandwidth than we were previously able to. In the near future, something we could do is increase our observing time on current telescopes, although maybe these days we have to back up a step and say, hey, we need to keep our current telescopes operating rather than shutting them down. And then longer term, what we want to eventually do is move to something, hopefully as we're moving from the just barely making a detection phase into more characterizing gravitational wave phase, we're eventually going to want bigger telescopes, so something like a square kilometer array. This is kind of a long-term thing, though.
So, what do you mean with the smaller dimension of times? Because you're not filtering, right?
Sorry, what's that?
You're not filtering the same way. Your receivers are not filtering, but you want more.
Well, there's just different analyses. Like, the analysis you do to look for one of these bursts is different than what you would do to look for the isotropic stochastic background. So that's all I mean by that. Like, I think our stochastic background analysis might be sensitive to bursts, but it's not optimal for that.
Are you doing some prime phase lighting checking?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. I don't have those details in this talk, but yeah, all these algorithms go through various injections and stuff. Yeah. So I was just going to mention briefly the number of increasing millisecond pulsars. This is mostly driven by the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope, which is now operating. It turns out that millisecond pulsars emit a lot of gamma rays, so when Fermi detects an unclassified gamma ray point source, it's been a very successful strategy to follow that up with a radio observation and search for a millisecond pulsar. So we've gone from the first 5 years of data I've been talking about was on 17 pulsars, and we're currently up to 35 in this experiment. I mentioned improving our use of our telescope resources. These projects were, so Green Bank and Arecibo are open access telescopes. Anyone can propose to do whatever astronomy you want to do on them. Our gravitational wave detection project currently takes up maybe something like 5% of the total available telescope time. We could imagine trying to boost this by a significant factor still. There's some more instrumentation upgrades we want to do to the telescopes. And then I definitely have to point out these days that, you know, this is a long-term project. We want to keep going for at least another 5 years, have a good hope of detecting anything. And so keeping both of these best telescopes operational is crucial to this project success. And these instruments do seem to come under kind of threat of being defunded every few years by the NSF.
Do you know what the prospects are for keeping both telescopes operated?
Right.
That's because there's quite a discussion about it.
The prospects, I mean, so the most recent thing is this report called the NSF Portfolio Review that came out a few months ago. It recommended Arecibo keep operating, but it recommended Green Bank be divested by the NSF. So we're currently exploring what that actually means for us. I think the general opinion is not that the GBT is going to shut down anytime soon, but we have to do something to try to get more money in the system to keep it going. Maybe money that's specifically targeted towards operating this project on the GBT, as opposed to just us proposing for the kind of open access telescope time, like has been our current model. But a few years back, it was Arecibo that was, you know, under the gun for being shut down with a different NSF review. So those things, you know.
So what's the level of operating funding that you need?
All right, so the total operations cost of the GBT, and it's about the same for Arecibo, is on the order of $5 or $6 million a year.
I remember that Arecibo was getting funding by renting themselves out to SETI. Is that a significant?
I don't think that was a very significant part. I think the SETI project funded some telescope upgrades and got a bunch of time for that. I don't think it was a continual input of money. Yeah, so there's various ideas along these lines, but it's still kind of uncertain right now. I'll show you the couple plots of how we expect things to progress over the next few years. So these colored lines on this plot, so this is signal to noise versus time as we continue to take more data. Net 2012 is here. The colored lines show what happens for different gravitational wave strengths. So there's kind of a major uncertainty in all this, is we don't know how strong the gravitational wave background is by about an order of magnitude. So if we were just to continue to run the current project with no modifications, you know, that's what the red line shows here. You can see the black line ramping up as we make some of these improvements that I just mentioned in terms of adding more pulsars and better instrumentation and such. And the kind of bottom line plot of this is that if the gravitational wave background has an amplitude of 10 to the minus 15, which is kind of the middle of the projected ranges, there's something like a 90% chance of detecting it by 2018. So that's the kind of time frame that we're talking about. Okay, I was going to move on for the last couple minutes to talk a bit about something I've been working on a lot recently, which is a related topic, which is how to deal with the effects of the interstellar medium on the signal. And so what's going on here is, if we go back to our little pulsar cartoon here, the radio waves are propagating not just through the nice Ripley space-time metric, but they're propagating through all this other junk that exists in our galaxy, which is ionized gas of various sorts. So just due to simple radio wave propagation through a plasma, the fact that the radio signals have to travel through the ISM to us and everything is moving with different speeds in different directions affects the signal processing and the pulsar timing results in various ways. The biggest effect that we have to deal with no matter what is simple dispersion of the signal. And this is just that higher your radio frequency is, higher radio frequencies travel faster through the ISM plasma. So as you go up in radio frequency, this is pulse phase versus radio frequency plot. As you go up in radio frequency, you see your pulses arrive earlier and earlier. And you have to subtract this out to even detect pulsars, millisecond pulsars. So this is a very basic effect. It's sensitive to the total column density of free electrons between the pulsar and the Earth. And that we call that value dispersion measure, and it's what sets the slope of this. So this has a characteristic 1 over frequency squared times a constant, and the constant is this dispersion measure. Yeah?
So where are your pulsars? Are they inside the Milky Way? Or?
Yeah, they're in the Milky Way, right?
Is there anyone like in LMC?
There are a couple known, I think, in the SMC, but they're very weak. So
you,
it's,
you don't use them?
Not for this experiment, no. Right, yeah, the millisecond pulsars are fairly weak radio sources, you know, compared to some things like quasars and such. So we can only detect ones in our galaxy with the current sensitivities.
You can do this measure even for second parts, for other types of parts.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah.
If you're just interested in this measure, there are more.
Yep, that's right. You get much more accurate DM values from millisecond pulsars, but yeah, you always have to account for dispersion. It's a huge effect. So one thing I spend a lot of time doing is building instruments like this that apply a filter that is matched to this version measure of a pulsar to remove the smearing in real time from the radio signal and sharpen up the pulse. So it's kind of hard to see, but you get a much sharper pulse and therefore a much better time of arrival if you can apply this dispersion filter, what we call a coherent dispersion filter, and remove the DM smearing. So this is the new instrument that I mentioned earlier in the talk that's now able to process an order of magnitude more bandwidth, and it's basically because we switched everything to doing it in GPUs instead of, you know, five-year-old computers like the old system was using. On top of having to just remove the dispersion is also changing with time. So as the pulsar is moving, the Earth's moving, the line of sight from the pulsar to the Earth is moving with respect to the ISM. And so you get this variation in DM versus time. And in these units, 10 to the minus 3 DM units, this roughly corresponds to microseconds. So if you don't remove this, this is a timing signature with an amplitude of microseconds. So that's much bigger than a gravitational wave. So we have to track this and remove it. And the way we do that is by observing it at a couple different radio frequencies. So here's timing residuals without accounting for the DM variation. You can see these big deviations at low frequency and small deviations at high frequency. But we use basically the difference between these two to measure the DM and subtract it out. So that's all fairly well understood. And it's, from a timing perspective, maybe kind of annoying to have to deal with. But we have a good handle on how to do it. What
so
we have
your final source of sort of irreducible noise is how well you can characterize this. You know, maybe there's one scale structure in that stuff.
In the ISM? Or just in the experiment in general? Yeah, so it's kind of a tricky subject. I think the ISM is not the final source of noise for all pulsars. You know, some pulsars have intrinsic spin fluctuations. That's a more troubling source of noise as far as gravitational wave detection goes. I don't know, it's one of these questions. There's things fall into different classes.
And stated in another way, so you were showing, for example, that why does pulsar at the moment have
40 nanoseconds arm? Yeah. Typical second one does microseconds or something like that. What fraction of that do you think is due to interstellar medium, and what fraction of that is due to pulsar itself? Right. So we think that, so I think most of that is due to just signal to noise, so just noise in our detectors here. So I should have mentioned that in the analysis I showed before with the 40 nanoseconds up to a microsecond, that's all been DM corrected. So we are measuring the dispersion measure and taking this effect out. Yeah, if we didn't, it would be by far the biggest effect for some of these pulsars.
I mean, in other words, I guess maybe I'm preempting what you're about to talk about.
Yeah.
You're about to talk about the fact that you're going further.
Yeah, that's right.
More
yeah, I was going to talk about the kind of higher level ISM stuff a bit. But it's not actually.
I'm asking about that.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of thing where the hope is that will actually reduce?
The hope is that it.
Small.
Right. Or, yeah. Yeah.
And you have a many. Okay. So it is fair. Just
random. That's okay. Specifically for those pulsars, I think the 40 nanosecond ones are ones that have fairly clean. They're fairly clean as far as ISM effects go. Some of the worst ones, lower down on that table, I think, are dominated by scattering, and so some of the stuff I'm about to talk might help those get down to the level we want them to. But the 40 nanoseconds, I don't think that's for those particular pulsars. I don't think that's an ISM limit. I think that's more of just a signal to noise limit. So I'll go through this stuff kind of quickly because we're getting to the end here. But the dispersion measure just measures the overall column density of free electrons between the pulsar and the Earth. But what's a little more tricky to deal with, but potentially a lot more rewarding in terms of information we can get out of it, is the multipath propagation. So basically, you know, if you have radio waves coming from pulsar to Earth, you know, if the ISM is inhomogeneous, there's actually scattering. So the radio wave propagating here gets refracted off a bit of ISM, say, and put back into the line of sight towards Earth. And then these two things interfere because this is a spatially coherent point source here. We basically are observing an interference pattern between radio waves that propagated directly towards us and ones that were deflected back into our line of sight by some ISM along the way. And so that's what leads to these kind of patterns, so these variations in pulsar signal strength versus radio frequency. Right, so for this particular pulsar, we see a lot of these little scintillation patterns. So this is also called scattering or scintillation, kind of depending on what context you're talking about. So we see this fluctuation in radio pulsar signal strength versus frequency, which is basically caused by these interference effects. And depending on the frequency scale of this, you know, that's the kind of thing that can cause those large variations in the timing error bars. Because some days you happen to, your pulsar happens to be bright due to the ISM, some days it happens to be weak due to the ISM.
Is this observation or simulation?
Sorry, is this what? No, this is real data over here. Yeah. And so the typical way people have studied this, you know, since pulsars have been known, is by creating what we call dynamic spectra. And so this is basically just a time frequency plot. So this was a single kind of 1 minute chunk of data at first step for this one particular pulsar. You do this over, say, half an hour, and you plot the amplitude of the pulse signal as a function of time and radio frequency. You can see these very interesting interference patterns that have these kind of crisscross shapes evolve with time. And this is, you know, this is nothing particularly new. This has been known for decades in pulsar studies. It's kind of an interesting way of, you know, aside from what it does to our timing, it's been an interesting tool for studying the ISM. So if you take the 2D Fourier transform this interference pattern, you can often see these really interesting parabolic features, which are sort of thought to indicate anisotropy in the ionized gas in the ISM, and or these kind of little discrete clumps of material that cause these discrete features here. And people are still trying to figure out exactly what they are and where they come from. But one thing that's a little bit problematic about all this, or not problematic, but non-optimal, is that none of this really used any of the nice feature of the intrinsic time variability of the pulsar. So this isn't using the fact that the pulsar is pulsed. This is just looking at its total, you know, its average intensity evolving with time and frequency. So recently I've been looking into some methods of bringing that information in, and I kind of stumbled across a branch of statistics dealing with what's called cyclostationary signals. So these are signals that you know, are periodic, but otherwise their signal statistics are stationary. And so if you measure something like this quantity here, a pulse phase resolved correlation. So I'm not just taking the average intensity of this pulse profile, which is what I would have done to get a point in my dynamic spectrum before. I'm looking at the correlation between the radio waves that came in here and the radio waves that came in here. And so I'm getting a 2D correlation plot, lag, so time lag, tau here, as a function of pulse phase here. This makes use of the fact that you had this original spatially coherent radiation pattern from the pulsar going through this ISM scattering screen. That means there is a coherent phase relationship between the wave that arrived here and the wave that arrived here. So it was scattered back into the line of sight. So you take the 2D Fourier transform of this, you get something which is referred to in the signal processing literature as the cyclic spectrum. So it's the 2D Fourier transform of that quantity I showed on the last plot. And this actually has a pretty neat relationship where you can think of the interstellar medium as basically a filter or transfer function. And you can deconvolve the sort of pre-ISM pulse shape from what we finally observe here on Earth with kind of minimal assumptions about anything. So you don't have to assume any particular form for the filter. You don't have to assume any particular form for the pulse shape, only that it's roughly radio frequency independent. So you can do this deconvolution and get from what we would usually observe. So this is the scattered pulse, the dashed line here. So this is this pulse has been smeared out because things were coming out away from the line of sight, you know, got a delay, and then we're scattered back in. So that smears the pulse out in time. You can deconvolve basically that filter from the pulse shape, and you get the intrinsic pulse profile, which is the sharp line here. The other thing this gets you, which is interesting, we're still exploring exactly how to use it from the ISM perspective, is that this gets you basically a dynamic spectrum which has not just intensity versus time and frequency, but also phase as well. So dynamic spectrum with phase here. And you can use this in exactly the same way to view these kind of parabolic features. Those are a couple pretty plots that I went through quickly. But we're still trying to work out exactly how best to use this to correct the pulsar timing residuals. There was initially a lot of excitement about this. You know, we've since thought about it some more, and there are some limitations. So this works. One thing to note is that this works best for highly scattered pulsars, so where those scattering delays are longer in time than the intrinsic pulse width. And these are not the pulsars we observe typically for pulsar timing arrays, because we're trying to avoid systematic effects like this. So for most of the pulsars, this gets back to your, the thing we were just discussing. For most of the pulsars we're currently observing, I think they're not dominated by scattering, but that's just because we avoided those pulsars on purpose. So this might let us use observations of some pulsars that otherwise would have been too noisy before in our pulsar timing array projects. Another thing that's problematic is that you need enough signal to noise per scintillation timescale. So this thing is evolving with time. So this is 30 minutes here and a few megahertz of radio bandwidth. And this is basically the frequency representation of that filter. So it's evolving with time due to everything moving. So you need a pulsar that's bright enough for you to do this deconvolution process in the characteristic time scale of these little, what we call scintils, the scintillation elements.
Can I ask about that?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So the 40 nanosecond ones, you have some way of knowing that the spread of 40 nanoseconds is not due to scintillation.
Right.
How do you know that?
Along with every time of arrival measurement, we get an error estimate, just based on the noise in the data. And, with things being very, so one way of knowing this is that things are basically consistent with their error bars. Another thing is that, this has a number of time scales that it evolves on. So if you don't see these kind of characteristic variations on the ISM timescales, you can argue that the noise you're seeing is not ISM. And also, if you don't see a strong radio frequency dependence, it's probably not ISM. So it's not like one clear-cut thing, yes or no, but there's kind of a combination of a lot of factors like this. Whereas for some of the worst timing pulsars, we use those same factors to argue that it probably is ISM causing the noise there.
Okay. Yeah. But then as you get more and more signal to noise ratio on that 40 nanosecond pulsar, you could get into the region where you're feeding it down so that you
Yeah, definitely.
So, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, the basic fact is that the effective gravitational waves doesn't depend on frequency, but the effective ISM does depend on frequency. So, this separation seems like as long as you have multiple frequency measurements at any observation, you can just completely separate the two from each other, right?
Right. So, this is just details of how to do that best, basically. Yeah, that's right, though. But that's the basic principle. But the thing that's troublesome is the intrinsic pulsar spin fluctuations, what we call timing noise.
Yeah.
That is also frequency independent.
Sure.
So that's hard to deal with.
Problem, and hopefully you have multiple parts of the problem. Mm-hmm. That's not
it. Right. Yeah. Okay, so that was my last slide. Here's the couple conclusions. And any discussion if you guys want. Thanks. Yeah.
When the ESKA comes online, how much is this project going to improve via the ESKA into the data?
Yeah, so the ESKA is basically an order of magnitude improvement
in
radio collecting area. Yeah, so in sensitivity, that's right. That basically directly translates into time of arrival precision and gravitational wave sensitivity modulo when you actually hit some of these other systematic effects, which isn't not very well known in a global sense yet. But yeah, given the fact that we're with our experiments now, I didn't review all of the various predictions for how strong the gravitational waves are, but the basic idea is that we're with most people's predictions for how strong the sources are, we're within a factor of a couple of having enough sensitivity to detect them with the current experiments. So being an order of magnitude better is should definitely push us well into the detection realm.
Mm-hmm. How much could you do with using current telescopes? So if you couple the European telescopes, if you include the European telescopes.
Oh, how much better does that make the measurement? It actually, it's a good thing, kind of a good thing to do politically, and there's no reason we shouldn't do it. But it actually doesn't improve things all that much because it turns out we're mostly observing.
You'd be having a big record.
Yeah, I know. Let's see. So we're mostly the thing is we're mostly observing all the same pulsars, right? So there's very high overlap in the sources between all the three different pulsar timing experiments. Modulo exactly what piece of the sky the various telescopes can see. So combining them together improves things, but it's sort of a more like a square root of number of telescopes effect rather than a proportional to number of telescopes. So yeah, definitely better, but you know, maybe 50% better or something than what we're doing now.
Right? I mean, you could change the strategy and sort of different pulsars, you know, that's the dominant source of noise is intrinsic to the pulsars themselves as opposed to purely collecting.
Yeah. Right.
You have to find them. I mean, have you exhausted all of the pulsars that are easily found already?
No, there's some ongoing searches. So I mentioned the Fermi stuff, where you know, the fact that we've doubled the number of sources over the last 2 years shows that no, we have not exhausted the number that are out there. You know, we exhausted the number that were known at the time when we started the project, but there have been a lot more discovered since then. So the Fermi thing's been really helpful.
Go use all the pulsars. Yep. And say, yeah, we're doing that part, but
So one thing we're using the big telescope for is just doing blind searches as well, so just scanning over large chunks of the sky to look for new pulsars. And it turns out that the northern hemisphere has actually not been deeply surveyed with modern radio telescopes like the GBT, which only started working, you know, about 10 years ago. So there's a big ongoing GBT pulsar survey to cover the whole northern sky, and it should find maybe another 10 to 20 MSPs at least, I think, that would be usable for this project.
Yeah,
probably something like that.
But the time scale is like a few years. So once you discover a pulsar, you need a few years of data before it can actually be used for 10 years.
Yeah. So we start observing it, but it's a few years before it becomes a meaningful component of the data set. Yeah.
But even at that, we're talking about a 50 or 60% improvement in the signal quality, right?
Mm. Yeah, something like that.
So I thought one of the big selling points of the SKA was that it would be an amazing instrument to find, especially heavily dispersed pulsars. This was the argument finding pulsars in the galactic center with this.
So that is a really kind of a special purpose project. So I talked a bit about scattering these multipath effects already. For various reasons, people want to find a pulsar at orbiting the massive black hole at the center of our galaxy, because that would be a really cool thing to do GR stuff with. The problem is that the ISM problem is even worse. In that case, because there's so much stuff down at the center of our galaxy, that the scattering makes it basically impossible to use normal pulsar search strategies. So for the specific purpose of finding pulsars at the galactic center, you want to increase your observing frequency, your radio observing frequency, to beat the scattering that way. So you want to observe at like 10 to 20 gigahertz, as opposed to down around 1 gigahertz, where we do most of the normal MSP observations. So for that project, definitely SKA would be helpful if it can get up to 20 gigahertz, depending on what design they use.
Don't they have all these advertisements that they're going to find some enormous number of pulsars for these kinds of projects?
Probably.
Maybe I misremembered.
No. You mean the SKA propaganda or whatever. I think they'll find, I mean, they say they're going to find, you know, 80% of all the pulsars in our galaxy or something like that, right?
So what would that bring it up to?
It would probably be, I mean, I think, just thinking about this, it would probably be a factor of several improvement, I'd say, maybe 5. Yeah.
I've looked these numbers up as it happens, and I don't know whether you regard these numbers as realistic, but some of the SKA science, some papers that sort of estimate the gravitational science out of it, they kind of estimate that there would be hundreds or maybe possibly more than 1,000 pulsars in the galaxy with time and residuals sort of less than 100 nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Sound reasonable?
Hundreds might be reasonable, maybe slightly optimistic. Thousands sounds maybe a little overly optimistic to me. You know, we have tens now, maybe on order 40 or 50 if you consider, you know, everyone's doing throughout the world. So yeah, hundreds would be possible for SKA, I think.
Let me ask a provocative question. A couple of years ago, there was this paper that claimed that gravitational waves have already been seen by pulsar researchers. It was from this lone Russian who wasn't associated with any group.
Yeah.
I never saw anyone totally debunk that paper. So tell me, why has it been met with crickets? Why should I think it was totally crazy?
Well, everyone, so as you inferred, most people don't believe that claim. And I think my opinion is that his data analysis methods are kind of a little suspect. Some of the things he was doing in terms of, I think he had some kind of creative methods of trying to filter out, filter the data for what an expected gravitational wave would look like that may not have been properly accounted for. So he was basically, you know, filtering out things that he wants to look like a gravitational wave and then saying, hey, it looks like a gravitational wave.
Isn't that what LIGO does?
Yeah, but there's match filtering, but there's the right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. Right?
It's called
unwanted
searches.
Yeah.
I mean, the bottom line is that he was looking at pulsars that the other groups are also studying.
That's true, too. Yeah, it's not been replicated in other people's data.
Maybe that's a good point to stop. Okay. So let's thank Paul again.
All right, thank you.